I'm Rob Sivak, in for Tom Hall, and this is Midday. The debate over the future of hydraulic fracturing in Maryland is heating up, with growing numbers of towns and counties across the state voting to ban the controversial natural gas drilling method, also known as fracking. But with a changing political and economic landscape, dueling studies of fracking's health and environmental impacts, and new state drilling regulations, will Maryland's lawmakers vote this January to impose a permanent ban on fracking, or will they allow it to proceed when the moratorium ends next year? Guest host Nathan Sterner spends the next hour exploring the road ahead for fracking in Maryland, its risks and its benefits, with two leading voices in the debate, Drew Cobbs, the executive director of the Maryland Petroleum Council, and anti-fracking activist Mitch Jones of Food and Water Watch. And we invite you to join the conversation, which begins right after the news.
Welcome to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Tom Hall. This hour, we take a look at hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, a technique that can be used to drill for oil and natural gas, which involves injecting water, sand, and chemicals into the ground at high pressures to fracture the underlying rock. Fracking has expanded rapidly across the U.S. in the past few years. Much of that has been in the western states, but there are also thousands of fracking operations in the east, in a rock formation known as the Marcellus Shale. The Marcellus Shale runs beneath much of Pennsylvania and parts of West Virginia, as well as Garrett and Allegheny counties in western Maryland. There also may be some gas deposits in different rock formations in other parts of our state. Back when he was governor, Democrat Martin O'Malley established a review panel to examine the potential environmental and health impacts of fracking, as well as its potential economic benefits. That commission recommended that fracking be allowed to move forward, but with caution and rigorous regulation. Then Republican Larry Hogan was elected governor. Shortly after he took office, the General Assembly got in the way, passing a 2-year moratorium on fracking, which Hogan decided not to veto. But that moratorium is set to end in October of next year. David Vanko, the chairman of the so-called fracking commission that made the initial cost-benefit review, spoke with WYPR this past September. Vanko said he thinks the commission's fracking recommendations struck a reasonable balance.
We felt that given all the factors that we were trying to balance, that we came up with the strongest possible set of best practices and monitoring recommendations and regulation recommendations and financial assurance recommendations that all taken together would allow the state to do this with minimal risk, but not no risk. Nobody is trying to suggest that.
Vanko said the final report from Maryland's Environment Department did not rule out the prospect that new information about fracking could be factored into the revised drilling regulations, but he also added that some of the department's draft regs appear to be weakening the state's regulatory control.
My personal inclination is to say that if MDE proposes new regulations that are significantly weakened, like these appear to be, that's only going to lend weight to the argument that we're not ready to do this without taking on more risk than we should.
That's former Fracking Commission Chair Dr. David Vanko, Dean of the Fisher College of Science and Mathematics at Towson University. He spoke last September with senior producer Rob Sivak. In the weeks since that conversation, the Environment Department has published the new fracking regulations. They're open for public comment until December 14th. And there have been growing signs that public support is growing for a permanent fracking ban. Members of the state Senate have vowed to introduce legislation in the General Assembly this January that would impose such a ban. The Baltimore City Council and the Prince George's County Council have passed fracking bans, as have a growing number of townships in western Maryland counties that might actually see the technique be used. So, will fracking eventually be allowed in Maryland? Should it? What about the potential environmental and health risks? And what about the potential economic benefits to the state and to landowners? We welcome your thoughts on fracking this hour. You can email midday@wypr.org, or you can call us at 410-662-8780. Joining me in studio this hour is Mitch Jones, senior policy advocate at Food and Water Watch. He represents the organization in Congress and in Maryland on a range of issues, including water infrastructure, agricultural policy, and fracking. Mitch, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone from his office in Annapolis is Drew Cobbs. He's the executive director of the Maryland Petroleum Council, the local arm of the American Petroleum Institute, the oil and gas industry lobby group that has been spearheading efforts to develop the Marcellus Shale Reserve in Western Maryland. Drew, thanks for spending some of your afternoon with us.
Sure. Good afternoon.
So let's start with you, Drew. Could you give us the industry's view on why developing these Marcellus Shale Reserves is a good idea?
Well, this is a great opportunity, you know, especially for Western Maryland. You know, just as you stated before in your summary of fracking, is this Marcellus Shale touches far Western Maryland, and for that local economy in Garrett County, this could potentially be quite a boom for them. This area is being developed in West Virginia and Pennsylvania already, in Eastern Ohio, and so it's an opportunity for Western Maryland.
A great opportunity for Western Maryland, you say. How big of a boom would it be? How many jobs? How much money are we talking?
Well, it's just there are different estimates of that. And I think the one thing you have to take in account is with these proposed regulations that are very strict, maybe the strictest in the entire country relative to fracking, it would limit what areas that could be developed. We've yet to see, they initially, for the first draft of the regulations, they had done an overlay or map to show how much county or land would be available for that. And I suspect that probably somewhere up near 90%+ would be off limits in Garrett County. So some of those estimates really at this time don't hold just because of you know, what the regulations would restrict.
You said that the rules would be the toughest on fracking in the nation. That's echoing a comment made by Department of Environment Secretary Ben Grumbles. Mitch Jones, what do you think about the rules for fracking?
Well, we at Food and Water Watch and our allies in the Don't Frack Maryland campaign actually don't believe that any regulations will give us the level of protection that we need from fracking. We think that if you look across the country, and actually across the world where fracking has taken place, there are always harms that come with it. And in fact, the clip you played of Dr. Vanko emphasized that. He said that there would not be no risk, even with regulated fracking. There's going to be a risk. We don't believe that bringing fracking to Maryland is worth the risk to the public health, but also, quite frankly, to the economy in Western Maryland, which currently is built on tourism and second home properties. And we believe that bringing fracking to Allegheny and Garrett County will undermine a lot of the local economy and the homegrown businesses that are there.
What do you think about that, Drew Cobbs, the economy existing in Western Maryland and how it could change if fracking comes to the state?
Well, obviously, it's one of the most depressed parts of Maryland. Yes, there's some tourism, but unfortunately, a lot of the tourism jobs are seasonal best or for students or you know, part-time jobs. They can't really support families. So I think, you know, as anything, we're just trying to strike a balance here of what can be done and what can be safely and responsibly done. Another thing I'll say relative to the risk, I mean, yes, there is some risk, but was rated as very low, you know, by the commission in their review. And I'll just, again, go back to what you referred. After, you know, 3.5 years of study by, you know, Governor O'Malley's commission and then the individual departments of Environment and Natural Resources studying this, they came to the conclusion, and I quote, "The best practices, as long as provided all the best practices are followed and the state is able to rigorously enforce compliance, the risk of Marcellus Shale development can be managed to an acceptable level." So, I mean, yes, there's risk in everything. We get in a car a day, there's risk involved with that. You get on an airplane, there's risk. But the question is, can it be managed appropriately? And as long as it's done correctly, there won't be significant problems.
As long as it's done correctly, how do we ensure that it is done correctly?
Well, to start with, we go back to, you know, this is now, what, 5+ years ago, when the Department of Environment came to make sure they had appropriate resources to monitor this activity. And this is before any of the controversy exploded. And our industry, as a matter of fact, I was the only person that testified on that bill in support of it, to make sure they got sufficient resources and permit fees and things to make sure they had the staff and the ability to oversee the industry at that time. And that measure was enacted back in 2010, I believe.
Mr. Jones, yep. What do you think about the possibility of regulating it properly?
Well, again, I don't believe that it's possible. And, you know, the fact that MDE couldn't even get the regulations out on time doesn't suggest that they're necessarily staffed properly to even enforce whatever regulations might be put in place. And, you know, Drew said they need to be, quoting the commission, said that they would need to be rigorously enforced. I just don't believe that there's any hope, especially under the current administration, that the Department of Environment will have the resources necessary for what would be considered rigorous enforcement. And at the same time, yet again, there will be a risk. And it's not the same as the risk of when I get in a car and go for a drive, right? We're talking about a risk of poisoning, contaminating people's drinking water aquifers. It's not the same. They're not equivalent.
Let's talk about the risks. Can you go specifically into the drinking water risk?
Well, it's been shown in a variety of areas where fracking has occurred that there can be leakage underground, or there can be spillage above ground that causes either, if it's underground, there could be methane migrating into drinking water, or there could be the hydraulic fracturing fluid, which is a mix of chemicals and other things. It's considered to be a proprietary trade secret for companies that gets pumped in to actually fracture the well, that can, when the well casings deteriorate, which they all do over time, leak into people's drinking water. And, you know, this has been shown to have happened. Water contamination has been shown to have happened across the country where fracking has taken place. And once that happens, folks have to have water trucked into their homes in order to have water for bathing, cooking, drinking, and so on and so forth.
Drew Cobbs, I think I mostly understand how fracking works, that you force water into the rock to sort of break it up. Why does the water need to go along with these chemicals?
Well, the water and the force and the pressure behind the water helps crack those fractures and expand them. There's sand also in that mixture that goes down, and that ends up holding those pores sort of open, so that then releases the natural gas as you go forward. But if I'd like to just touch on one of Mitch's points, I'd like to point out the Environmental Protection Agency. Under the Obama administration, they did a six-year, multi-year, multi-million dollar national study, and they came to a conclusion that fracking has not led to widespread systematic impacts on drinking water. And this is extremely broad-based, obviously a very credible source. So I sort of disagree with Mitch. Now, that report probably will become final here by the end of the year, but that was the initial draft conclusion on that. And the industry, I think there's sufficient quantitative data to back that up.
Of course, the review panel, internal review panel at the EPA that looked at that draft report has actually asked the EPA to come up with some evidence for that top-line conclusion, because the scientists reviewing the report say there isn't any evidence in the report itself to justify the top line conclusion of the report. They say there's no quantitative evidence. There's no definition in the report of what widespread or systemic means.
And yeah, that was my question. What exactly do those words mean?
They're not defined in the report. And so the scientific panel that's been asked to review that report internally at EPA has asked the EPA to actually justify that finding. And we've heard from contacts at the EPA that finding was actually put in as a political decision made at the White House and was not put in by scientists at the EPA.
Mr. Cobbs, do you know what widespread and systematic means, systemic mean in this case?
And as far as the definition, no, I don't know exactly what they were thinking on that. But it said, in the end, and Mitch and I probably both agree, it's end up sort of a political issue debated here, but the bottom line is the facts back that up, and that's what we think eventually will be in the final report. You know, I think there was concern from opponents of fracking that was something obviously they did not want to hear or accept in that. But that is by far the broadest, widest study that's been done on this topic, a multi-year, multi-million dollar study.
That's Drew Cobbs. He's on the phone with us from Annapolis, and he's the executive director of the Maryland Petroleum Council, which has been leading the campaign to allow hydraulic fracturing or fracking operations to start in western Maryland. Mitch Jones is also joining us this hour. He's senior policy advisor with Food and Water Watch, a nonprofit health and environmental group that is part of the Don't Frack Maryland Coalition. We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we hope you'll join in the conversation as well. Do you think Maryland's economy will benefit from this kind of gas drilling operation? Are you worried about the potential health and environmental impacts, of which we will speak about more after the break? Give us a call to share your thoughts, 410-662-8780, or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, sitting in for Tom Hall. A programming note, looking ahead to Midday on Monday, another installment in our monthly series, Living Questions, a look at the role of faith in the public sphere. Tom Hall will be back talking with two religious scholars and a Lakota Sioux educator about how the protests over an oil pipeline in North Dakota have thrown a spotlight on Native American spirituality and the legal battles over protection of sacred tribal sites. That's Monday on Midday with Tom Hall. Today we are discussing the prospects for fracking in Maryland with Mitch Jones, senior policy advocate at Food and Water Watch, and Drew Cobbs, executive director of the Maryland Petroleum Council. And we do have a statement that was sent to us by Maryland Secretary of the Environment Ben Grumbles, which we've alluded to earlier. The statement reads as follows on the regulations, the draft regulations that were published just this week. These will be the most stringent and protective environmental shale regulations in the country. The law passed by the General Assembly requires the agency to issue hydraulic fracturing rules, and this comprehensive package is an important step in meeting that responsibility. If hydraulic fracturing ever comes to Western Maryland, these rigorous regulations will be in place beforehand to help ensure safe and responsible energy development. The most stringent and protective environmental share regulations in the country, he says. What are regulations like in other places, and why are they less stringent, and what have been the issues surrounding that?
Well, I think that in many states, they started fracking before they had any real regulations in place. And so the problems that you see are ones that we've already discussed. You talk about contamination to drinking water. And, you know, I've actually traveled to Dimock, Pennsylvania, and I've sat in the homes of folks up there who can't use the water in their wells because it's been contaminated. They have to have water trucked in to their homes. They have what they call water buffaloes, which are essentially giant multi-hundred-gallon tanks that they have to use for all of their uses for water. There's air pollution. You know, when you bring fracking to a community, you don't just bring wellheads and drilling rigs. You bring pipelines and compressor stations. You bring truck traffic. You know, it really does industrialize a rural community. And so a lot of the infrastructure that is built up around the actual drilling for natural gas are areas that have not been regulated to an extent where, you know, folks are actually protected. And again, you know, it's our position that no regulation is going to actually be protective enough when we're talking about things like contaminating aquifers. You know, again, it's not the same level of risk as, you know, leaving your front door. Of course, everything has a risk. But what we're talking about is a drilling practice that could actually completely decimate people's ability to enjoy their the property that they own and the homes that they live in because they're no longer able to use the water, which also completely obliterates the property value, their ability to sell their home, their ability to move. It's devastating when these problems happen.
Drew Cobbs, how are we going to be certain that such problems will not happen here, that the regulations we do have will be enforced?
Well, look, I think probably the best thing to look at is Maryland has taken an extremely cautious approach to this. You know, we've been in probably looking at this or considering this for 5+ years already, as I alluded to before, you know, that the commission that the Governor O'Malley had established studied it for three and a half years. The regulation drafting process has taken another year and a half to 2 years to get to where we are at this point. So this has been, you know, thoroughly looked at and vetted. They looked at other states and what they had done and learned from their experiences. And I think Mitch made a point, that some of these states, some of the activity occurred before there were regulations in place or sufficient regulations to address this. But, you know, states have addressed that and improved their regulations to address issues that were raised. And, you know, I allude to a point that I think it was Governor Rendell made that, you know, that they had, you know, gotten ahead of themselves, and that by 2010, when they finally adopted appropriate regulations in Pennsylvania, they addressed a number of the issues, and things have been fine since then on that. So, you know, Maryland's been very cautious. They've taken their time. They've addressed a lot of issues. I must admit, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, relative to, you know, we're competing against, you know, 20-some other states for this activity, you know, whether people will be able to operate under these regulations in Maryland that are so stringent. It's just, you know, it's hard to tell at this point. But there are a number of conditions in here, including comprehensive development plans and other things, extra requirements for casing and stringing of in the well itself, and things that aren't required in other states. Now, the other thing is you have to keep in account, too, that geology is different in different places. So that, you know, our geology here in Maryland and Western Maryland is different than places, other parts of the country, too.
Well, the first point I'd make is that I visited Dimock just 2 years ago, and so I don't know that I would say that things have just been swell since 2010 up in Pennsylvania. But, you know, in terms of the regulations that have been proposed, you know, both sets, both the proposal under the O'Malley administration and the current regulations, actually have ignored public health harms, purposefully ignored them. You know, the regulations are based on a 2013 report on best management practices. Now, there have been, it came out this week, a new compendium on fracking literature, peer-reviewed academic literature about fracking. There have been now 900 peer-review publications on the impacts of fracking, 900. About 200 of those roughly has come out in the past year, but the real bulk of those have come out since 2014. Now, the regulations that the O'Malley administration put together, and which the Hogan administration has used as the basis for theirs, are based on reports that were written in 2013 that looked at only two studies. There are now 900. They looked at two studies. And, you know, it just goes to show that the more we learn about this practice, the more it becomes clear that no level of regulation is going to be protective of public health. Of those 900 peer-reviewed studies, 84% of them indicate public health hazards, elevated risks, or adverse health outcomes because of fracking. 87% indicate elevated air pollution emissions, and 69% of them indicate a potential for actual evidence or water contamination. So of the reports that look at those issues, that's the percentage that find negative outcomes. The evidence is very, very clear that fracking, which is regulated, it is regulated in states, and these are studies looking at regulated fracking, that fracking has these negative public health and environmental outcomes.
We are also getting a lot of questions by email about earthquakes. An email from Michelle at Hopkins, who says she's pretty sure fracking has been linked to an unprecedented number of earthquakes in Oklahoma. Is it reasonable to assume that this sort of thing would or would not happen in Maryland? Let me turn that over to you, Drew.
Yeah, on that issue, the majority of the issues about concerns about earthquake or seismic activity is related to what's called injection wells. These are deeper wells where water or waste or other waste are stored. You know, they're EPA monitored on that. There are none in Maryland. And under the proposed regulations, there would not be any in Maryland. So that really is not issue here in Maryland at all.
Let me clarify that. So underground injection of wastewater would not be permitted under these regulations?
Injection wells would not be permitted in Maryland.
And that's
there are none now, and there would not be permitted under the regulations.
And that is what is connected to earthquakes,
right? The issues in Oklahoma and stuff is a combination of the amount of activity and specifically injection wells with the amount of fluid that was stored in them and the deep nature of those wells.
Yeah, I mean, there is growing evidence. The initial thought was that all of the seismic activity tied to hydraulic fracturing was because of the Class II injection wells that Drew was referring to. But there is growing evidence that the fracturing of the well itself, so the fracking practice, can be tied to earthquakes. In fact, last winter, there were two earthquakes in Canada. One was in British Columbia, I believe that was in December of last year, and there was another one in Alberta, which I believe was in January. One was a 4.6 magnitude, one was a 4.8, and both of those were tied to fracking, the process of actually fracturing the well itself, as opposed to these injection wells that Drew mentioned.
How much study has been done into the connection between fracking itself and earthquakes versus the injection wells in earthquakes?
You know, it's still early days on that because obviously, you know, the fracking boom really only began about a decade ago. So this is why we're beginning to see this outgrowth of research into fracking. And I think that the connection between earthquakes and fracking is a growing component of that. But, you know, at this point, we're still, you know, early in the days of the folks being able to get that, you know, it's hard to get an academic paper published. I used to be in academia. I know it's very difficult. It takes a long time. And so, you know, we're just in the early stages of that, and we're beginning to see those reports begin to come out. But clearly, you know, a lot more study needs to be done on that connection.
Without injection wells, what would we do with the wastewater from fracking operations, assuming fracking moves forward?
You know, our best guess, because MDE currently does not allow wastewater treatment plants in Maryland to treat fracking wastewater. And in fact, here in Baltimore, we worked at Food and Water Watch, and some of our allies in Don't Frack Maryland worked with Councilman Jim Kraft 2 or 3 years ago to prohibit the city wastewater plants from ever treating fracking wastewater. And that became an ordinance here in Baltimore. Baltimore City was the only city that had ever done so, although that was by accident and was stopped. So what seems most likely is that the water would be put on trucks and shipped out of state, either to West Virginia or Ohio, where it would either be treated or injected into wells.
Do you have any insight on that, Drew?
Yeah, let me touch on a couple points. One thing that's happened that's been a significant change is a lot more water now is reused or recycled on site. So the amount of waste is a lot less than it once was on that. And so that's been a very good trend here by the industry. So it's treated and then reused in the fracturing process as you go forward. The other thing I do want to state is, you know, I had an opportunity to attend a briefing at West Virginia University, and they've done, you know, some extensive studies. They're monitoring fracking sites right there in Morgantown, and also have done a number of research projects for the West Virginia legislature dealing with hydraulic fracturing and related issues on that. But it was interesting, the geologists there, and this was talking about wells, exploration production wells, you know, the regular frack well, not injection wells. But he had said that roughly they had studied worldwide, I think the number was 3 million wells, and they had found only 70 instances of any proposed or suggested seismic activity relative to those wells. And that was this geologist's conclusion at West Virginia University.
Going to the phones now at 410-662-8780. Cameron in Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm calling to ask Mr. Cobb to comment on the environmental threats beyond water contamination and the risk of earthquake. And speaking of greenhouse gas emissions, specifically from uncombusted methane gas that leaks from wells, which is a more potent greenhouse gas than CO2, and even the use of sand, which, as I recently learned, is an increasingly limited and precious resource. And it's heavily used in fracking.
Drew Copps?
Yeah, let me. I'll touch on sand first, and we'll go to methane. There is in the process called silica sand, which is the one that is used to help open or keep open those pores after you fracture fractured those. So that is part of the process. You know, it's important to hold those pores open. Otherwise, they would just reseal after you do the process. So that's an important part of the process. Now, on the methane issue, first of all, the industry has obviously in these cases spent, you know, millions of dollars to drill that well and open it and to get that product, to get that gas, so that methane. So it's obviously not in any way their interest to lose their product. Same as, you know, a brewery that's brewing, I don't think they want, you know, leaks in their line that lets the beer get out. You know, so that's the product they've gone after. So relative to methane, that obviously it is a gas. There are issues in the distribution network throughout, but I think there's some significant overestimations of what that entails. The other thing is natural gas, the product as far as, you know, the clean burning nature of it and power generation. If you look, I'm part of the Maryland mitigation work group for the Maryland Climate Commission. And according to them, to meet our goals here in Maryland of the 25% reduction of CO2 emissions by 2020, one of the significant parts of that is natural gas in the power generation. That's what's helping us achieve those goals on that. So it's become a very important part of that.
Studies by academics at Cornell University and elsewhere have shown that if you look at the complete life cycle of fracked natural gas, we're not talking conventional drilling for gas, but fracked gas, and compare it to the burning of coal, taking into account leakage not only in the distribution line, which would be the same for fracked gas as it would be for conventional gas, but leakage at the well pad and in some of the other infrastructure that fracked gas requires. If you take all of that in consideration, and if you add in the fact that methane is, as I believe Cameron was the name of the caller said, a much more potent greenhouse gas. In a 20-year time frame, methane traps 87 times more heat than CO2. When you take all of that into consideration, the fact that methane releases less carbon dioxide when it's burned than coal does is completely obliterated. And in fact, fracked gas is as bad for the environment, as bad for climate change, as coal. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, we just... You know, we don't have time to wait. You know, people used to talk about natural gas as a bridge fuel. Some people still do talk about that. Fact of the matter is, you know, it's a bridge to nowhere. We don't have time. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out a carbon budget, which is just a simple way of calculating how much more carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide equivalent can we release into the atmosphere before we are going to be forcing ourselves to have certain levels of global temperature rise over pre-industrial era. Right now, we're sitting at about 1 degree Celsius in rise. Everybody says if we get past 2, it's going to be a disaster. We're seeing climate change now. There's a lot of evidence that even at 1.5 degrees Celsius, we're going to hit tipping points that are going to fundamentally change a lot of ecosystems across the world. And the fact of the matter is, that fracked gas is going to, and a reliance on fracked gas, will eat up our carbon budget. We don't have much left. If you actually look at what the IPCC said, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said, based on their calculations, in order to have a better than 2/3 chance of avoiding 1.5 degrees temperature rise globally, we have roughly 4 years left of releasing greenhouse gas at the levels that we have. You know, and if you just look at the carbon dioxide level in fracked gas, even just that, if we were to burn the natural gas that we have that's just been discovered, we would blow through all of our carbon budgets. We cannot rely on gas. We need to hasten a transition to clean energy, solar and wind, which in many places is price competitive with even the very, very low rates that natural gas is currently getting on the market.
Any response, Drew?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The U.S. is leading the world in reducing carbon emissions, which are down to 20-year lows. And a good portion of this is due to the affordable and abundant availability of natural gas on that. So this switch from coal to natural gas has driven a lot of these reductions. I said in Maryland, I mean, that's what they've said. And the other thing is EPA states the same thing on that.
They don't look at the entire life.
And there are incremental steps you need to take as you move forward. But I would say that natural gas is part of the solution.
Those studies don't look at the entire life cycle, which is what I was talking about.
Well, we're going to have to take another quick break now. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Speaking this hour about the possibility of fracking coming to Maryland next year when a two-year moratorium comes to an end, with Mitch Jones of Food and Water Watch and Drew Cobbs of the Maryland Petroleum Council. And with you, if you give us a call. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner in for Tom Hall this hour. We are discussing the outlook for fracking in Maryland with Mitch Jones, Senior Policy Advisor with Food and Water Watch, and Drew Cobbs, Executive Director of the Maryland Petroleum Council. We are getting some notes on Twitter. Jessica sent us a tweet. I saw my home county in Pennsylvania ravaged by fracking. I do not want that happening to my now Western Maryland home. Regulations are not enough, says Jessica. Thomas Meyer says that he'd love to hear from Mitch about the opposition to fracking in Maryland and the Don't Frack Maryland Coalition. Also got another email from Rihanna, who says if people want to support a ban on fracking, what should they do?
Well, the Don't Frack Maryland Coalition is now a group of approximately 130 organizations, most of which are located here in the state. Some of them are regional. Some of them are national groups calling for a ban on fracking in Maryland. And, you know, we have been working with localities across the state that want to make sure that they're protected. And so we've worked with Baltimore City, which, you know, just passed a resolution calling for a statewide ban. We've worked with folks out in Frederick, a city ban out in Frostburg, Maryland, out in Western Maryland, went through what they call first reader last evening and is moving forward. Prince George's County has banned fracking within its borders, and there is gas under Prince George's County.
In a basin formation.
There is a basin, yeah.
Marcellus Shale is not the only type of rock formation that has natural gas within it.
Well, yeah, it's not the only gas basin in Maryland, although it would be the one that would be the first targeted by fracking if it is allowed in the state. Although the Taylorville Basin, which is in Virginia and comes up into southern Maryland, is being targeted for fracking down in Virginia, and I think we could believe that would eventually happen there as well. If you wanna ban fracking in Maryland, what you need to do is tell your state legislator to support a ban on fracking. Senator Bobby Zirkin from Baltimore County has said on numerous occasions now that he is going to introduce a bill to ban fracking. Delegate Shane Robinson from Montgomery County has said that if nobody else in the House of Delegates introduces a companion to Senator Zirkin's bill, he will do so. You know, there may be others who decide to take up that mantle, but at the moment, it's Delegate Robinson. And, you know, there will be bills and there will be a great effort, not only from the Don't Frack Maryland campaign, but I'm sure from the oil and gas industry as well, over this issue in the legislative session that begins in January.
And there has been some polling on this issue in recent months as well. An OpinionWorks poll conducted earlier this year found 56% of registered voters want a fracking ban and 28% do not. A Washington Post University of Maryland poll found 60% of voters opposed to fracking, 27% in favor. There was also an OpinionWorks poll specifically focused on Garrett County out in Western Maryland with the Marcellus Shale underneath it. That pretty much mirrored those two polls. 57% of voters in Garrett County in favor of a fracking ban, 27% opposed. Drew Cobbs, you're obviously not in favor of a fracking ban. Why do you think that fracking should go through, even if, as it appears, opinion in Maryland is against it?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say on a couple of those polls, especially OpinionWorks, that's what's affectionately called a push poll. I mean, the question was skewed to get the appropriate answer for those folks on that. If you look at some of the other polling that's done, we've done polling too, where you get a completely different answer, which, especially when you ask more a neutral question. That poll referred to what action the New York governor took. It didn't even say if it would have been a fair question. Maybe what it should have been something about Maryland studied this for 3.5 years, and this commission was involved, and they came to this conclusion. So it's all in how you ask the question or poll on that. So, but yeah, there's a split as far as obviously the public how they feel about this issue. No doubt about it. I also want to touch on this Taylorsville Basin, which, you know, I'll have to say some of the opponents sort of use this as a scare tactic. Yes, is there gas in that area? The Taylorsville Basin is a multi-state area basin on that, but it pales in comparison. It's a few percent compared to the Marcellus Shale. So if you're going to go fishing for, you know, rockfish, where do you go? You go to the Chesapeake Bay. You don't go to a pond, you know, up in Baltimore County. So it's just the reality of what's there and that what's that, you know, I think is quite a contrast. And there are no leases. There were over 100,000 acres leased in Allegheny County 5 years ago. So there's obviously a great deal of interest by the industry in that area. And as far as I know, unless Mitch knows otherwise, there isn't one other acre leased in any other part of Maryland that I've heard of or that I know of.
I am unaware of any leases in the other basins. I have had people tell me that they have had inquiries made, but I haven't been able to verify any of those. But again, in just over the Potomac River in Virginia, there are leases in the Taylorsville Basin. So, you know, there's gas there.
Drew, you referred to the possibility of drilling in the basin as a scare tactic. Why would it be scarier to have it done in southern Maryland than in western Maryland?
No, I think what I mean is in the short term, there's no prospect or interest in those areas in that. So what they're trying to say, oh, there'll be fracking right here. I mean, there have been comments made, oh, there could be fracking there next week or as soon as the moratorium's lifted, which just, you know, is not true. You know?
We got an email from Kenny who says, how do regulations protect from accidents or from unintended consequences? How can we know the impact in case of an accident or well casing failure? He adds the Maryland Department of the Environment doesn't necessarily have a strong record of enforcement and monitoring. So how do we have confidence in this area? Drew?
Well, obviously the department, you know, has reviewed this and looked at other states' regulations and what they proposed. And that, is there potential for accident? Yes, there is on that. But the regulations, and especially the additional safety mechanisms that were put in there on that, I think there's some redundancy in the regulations. And that's why there'll be both it's time-consuming to get through the permitting process, and it'll be costly to try to comply with them, because of those additional redundancies and assurances to make sure there isn't a problem.
How would we get? How would we transport the natural gas once it comes out of the ground? Pipeline, truck?
It would be pipeline.
Pipeline? So have we gone through the possibilities of where that pipeline would go? Is that already done?
A part of the comprehensive development plan that you would have to undertake if you were trying to develop here in Maryland would be deciding or showing where you expected to have what's called gathering lines that you put in. Eventually you would tie into a interstate natural gas pipeline network.
Going back to the phones, Eric in Middle River, welcome to Midday here on WYPR.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Well.
I appreciate your program. I just had a quick question that I can take the answer off the air.
Okay.
My question was, you were discussing the fact that the wastewater would be taken out of the area because it's against the regulations in Maryland to store it here. That would increase the cost. Does that make it so that it's not as economical feasible as you were discussing?
Yeah, I think that would be one factor if you looked in. Obviously, you know, in any business endeavor, when you look at this, you're going to look at what the total costs are, and that would be a cost factor there that you would have to consider, you know, as far as disposing of waste. So that's one of many things. But as I said, the thing with these regulations is the requirements on them obviously are very stringent and would add additional costs to try to comply with them and to be able to operate under that
that. So all sorts of things, whether they're what the tax environment is, what the cost is, what your lease payment, I mean, all those factors would get in whether it's potentially a profitable endeavor or not.
Also joining us on the line now, Jessica from out in Western Maryland in Frostburg. Jessica, welcome to Midday.
Hi there. Thank you.
Hi. What's your question?
Hi. I just actually had more of a statement, but I do have a question to lead it off. Mr. Cobbs, have you ever spent any time in Western Maryland?
I sure have.
You have. So you know how beautiful it is, correct?
I sure do.
Great. Well, I actually saw fracking happen. I lived there in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, when it happened in my hometown. The truck traffic, the people coming in from Louisiana and Texas, all of the workers. I won't belabor the environmental and pollution issues because you guys have covered those at length, and I appreciate that. But what I do want to say is, whether you believe the poll or not, I own a small, myself and my partner own a small piece of property in Garrett County, and he has lived there, his whole family's from Garrett County for generations. I just want to point out that though large landowners may make some money if fracking comes to Garrett County, those of us who do not have large parcels of land may very well end up with a well right next to our properties, and we can't afford that. We don't want that. We have a peaceful, beautiful way of life. And so regardless of whether you believe the poll or not, I'm telling you, I live in Garrett County. I've seen it happen. I don't want that in my county. And I know that there are a lot of others that don't as well.
We also got another call from a Garrett County property owner who's had to leave us, who asks whether the economic boom that's been predicted, if fracking comes to pass, will affect people locally. Will it employ locally about road changes or improvements, et cetera? Do you have any insights on that, Drew?
Yeah, I think some in the reference to what happened initially in Pennsylvania was obviously the expertise is needed. So in an area initially there is, you know, are folks from out of state or whatever, or experienced people, but then over time, and that's what's happened in Pennsylvania, much more of the local, the workforce is local, you know, on that. And a lot of the jobs and the spinoff and the subcontractors and activity as far as the pad development, those things are done by local companies on that. It's interesting, there's a group called Beitzel Corporation that's up in Garrett County, and they're involved in this process, but their workers have to go off to West Virginia and Ohio and Pennsylvania, every day or weekly to go do work on those things because there's no activity nearby here in Maryland.
Another call now from Western Maryland, Linda in the Deep Creek Lake area. Linda, welcome to Midday.
Well, thank you so much. I wanted to request to go backwards a little bit and have some more discussion on the poll. The poll that was recently taken, I feel, was done by a professional company. It was a professional poll. I read all about it, and it just seems to have been dismissed so quickly by one person's opinion on this radio show. Perhaps we could hear from Mitch Jones or someone else, because it just seems a little one-sided opinion on this poll. And again, I feel it's significant.
I'd be happy to do that. You know, I think that industry was quick to try to dismiss the OpinionWorks poll as a push poll. I would note that Drew didn't address the Washington Post poll, which showed numbers to be slightly higher than the supposed push poll in statewide opposition to fracking. Washington Post didn't do a Garrett-level county-specific ask in their poll, so we can't compare there. But, you know, the two polls come to very similar conclusions. And again, Washington Post, which couldn't be accused of having done a push poll, came out with similar numbers. So I think, you know, the evidence is clear, and it's been clear for several years now here in Maryland, that especially among people who follow the issue, who are aware of what fracking is, the majority of them oppose fracking. They don't want it coming to the state. They've seen what it's done elsewhere, and they don't believe that it is worth the risk to Maryland, to public health, to the environment, to the local economies and the businesses. You know, 120 business owners in Western Maryland signed a letter of support for the moratorium bill that passed in 2015. 120 business owners were worried that their businesses would be lost or damaged if fracking came. There is great opposition to fracking across the state.
And there is a lot more to talk about the issue of fracking in Maryland. Discussions will continue in the coming months as it goes before the General Assembly, but unfortunately that's going to be have to be the last word for this hour. We've been talking with Mitch Jones of Food and Water Watch and Drew Cobbs of the Maryland Petroleum Council. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nathan.
Take care. Thank you.
And the draft regulations for fracking unveiled just this week. Public comment for 30 days, and there will be a hearing on December 20th at 10 a.m. in Annapolis on the regulations. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Midday's produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Nathan Sterner. Tom Hall will be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend.